afternoon. I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for joining me for the 233rd edition of New Mainers Speak. This is a bi-weekly, half-hour program where you can hear firsthand about the lives of some of Maine's immigrants. During the show, we visit with individuals regarding their life stories and enduring hopes as new Mainers. My guest today is Abdi Iftin, originally from Mogadishu, Somalia, and now an American since January 2020. He's the author of the memoir called Call Me American, which was released in 2018 through Vintage Press, a division of Penguin Random House Books. On his first interview back on December 17th of 2017, Abdi described his childhood and how he was able to make his way to the United States. Much of this is detailed in Call Me American as well. During today's interview, we're going to talk more from a bird's eye view of what it's like to be an American now, after all that striving, and what it's like to write a book about the whole process. So welcome back to New Mainers Speak, Abdi.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back again.
Such a pleasure. Fun to be with you. First of all, let's talk about writing a book. I've never written a book. What's it like?
I think writing a book comes with joy and sorrow, and particularly depending on what story you're telling. In this case, mine was a bit of a debate in my own mind, because I knew that to write my story, I have to act like I'm digging up a lot of wound, going back to those childhood days when, you know, things have really not been that easy. So, and there are people involved in the story. For instance, my mother's involvement or help in collecting part of the story was also a feeling in me, which I felt guilty at some point because I had to ask her questions related to the death of my sister, the loss of our family member, you know, separation from our dad, and those moments when...
And you dove back into your life in a war zone and all the ramifications of that to find the story so that others could really just get a feel for what that was like there. And I think reading your book, you get a pretty amazing feel for what it might be like to live there year after year after year.
It also has a bittersweet feeling to write this story. I know not many people want to relive the past and the traumatizing moments, but I find healing in this, in going back and digging up the stories. Like you said, it's more like going up to the archives and picking up pieces of history that you might be looking at and say, my goodness, right?
At some level, it felt good to sort the pieces out and put the story together in a cogent way for yourself.
Yes. Yeah. And I really find it healing. I don't know what other people feel, but I think it comes with a lot of emotional pain, but that emotional pain can turn to be a healing process. And it did for me, honestly.
Is there a scene that you share in the book that sorting it all out made it easier and clearer for you to understand and feel?
Yeah, there's a lot of those. But let me say that it is, I think, you know, we're humans, we're forgetful. We might just not remember as much, you know. So collecting those kind of stories and putting them together and reading your own story or seeing your own story, because sometimes I listen to my own story on the radio, right? And then, like, let's say now it was 5 years ago when I did a documentary on This American Life, right? And then it was 10 years ago when I did a documentary on American public media. So today, as a U.S. citizen, for instance, someone who has the freedom and capability to travel anywhere in the world, buy any car, you know, rent any apartment, any city, anywhere in, you know, in this country, comparing to those and finding my own voice at a time when I lived in a hole that I used my own shovel to dig out the dirt, and I lived there mostly because to hide from a shelling. It's important to find that voice And it's important to feel it. So to me, it hits like a music. It hits like something that goes into your heart and puts tears on my eyes, but also puts a smile on my face. So it's just two things at the same time, right? In my mind, I have the adrenaline going, and it's a mix of pain and happiness. It's happiness because I'm here and alive, and I'm listening to it. And then that moment stays with me because I was that person. And I know exactly the smell of the place where I was in, the smell of the powder or the blood or the side of the dead body, you know, the houses that were completely destroyed, you know, houses sitting there, roofs missing, doors missing, windows missing. And here I am in a roof, the fridge, kitchen, you know, and all those things. So I think that's why it's really important that sometimes we have to create our stories and put them together and get them out there for people to read. Storytelling is art, and I belong to a community of storytellers. Somalis are said to be a nation of poets and poetry. We carry stories that were told orally from our ancestors. So my mom could talk about generations before her, and she couldn't mention the 35th name of her, you know, of her descendants or her family. And then each one of them has a story, beautiful story to tell. But I remember every story that she told me, how beautiful the nomadic life was, the animals, you know, the smell, the strong, powerful woman that she was, you know, how high she could jump, how she could wrestle with a hyena, you know, all those kind of things, which I wasn't very lucky to live that life because I was born when they moved to the city, right? And so we carry those with us. I didn't do anything extra except that I put it in a written form. You know, it's the story that I could be telling in Somali to my kids in the future, right? The same way that our parents tell us these stories. So at some point, what I'm doing is extending the way of storytelling from orally, you know, saying it into writing, which sort of is a new way, a new form of this generation or the next generation, because half of the Somali population are living outside of Somalia, and a lot of them are picking up foreign languages, and a lot of them are going to foreign schools, and even including those young so-called Somali Americans who were either born here or have moved in this country when they were very young. You know, those kind of people are the targets of my story. Because first of all, they don't remember much about Somalia, or they have never been to Somalia, right? But they cannot forget about it because this is the place their parents are talking about in their oral stories. So now you read this, and now you get to know the cultures, the tribal divisions, you know, the beauty of the land, how Mogadishu was nicknamed the Pearl of Africa, like the pearl. Like, it was so gorgeous. And now it's been nicknamed the world's most dangerous place, or the Valley of Blood. You know, I mean, it had carried all these names, and I think it's important for people to really know what is the difference. You know, how can the Pearl of Africa transform into something that is just nothing but a blood and dead body, and, you know, killings and destruction and violence. You know, so I think they don't get it. And the only stories out there are white people who went into Somalia and wrote their own stories based on their own observation, which may not be wrong, but they don't really get the sense of the true story. Like, they didn't live there. They didn't grow up. They don't know what a childhood was like, you know. So I added that to those moments where, like, I was a child who was there. I'm the one who has never went to school. You know, I'm the one who survived, you know, the snipers who were lined up in those empty buildings and only wanted to shoot you for fun, right? And now that I survived, I just need to put that down to encourage the young kids today to really see it and say, like, I should be very grateful for what I have.
Get such a more historical context for their parents' stories.
Yes.
From someone maybe closer to their age.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think you do that brilliantly in the book. I've spent a lot of time with children, and you have a child's eye view of a war. And as you're coming of age, your understanding of the conflict is coming of age. And the conflict keeps changing. And so I very much appreciated that. And I hope it does land well with other young people all throughout the country. Any English readers, mm-hmm. Yeah. Is the book reprinted in any other languages?
Yes. Arabic is the first language that we just reprinted. And actually, it came out in May 7, I think. May 7 was when the Arabic version was released in Kuwait, the Middle East. And they're still selling it.
Wow. That's so cool to know that your words are being read by the diaspora as well as other receiving communities
Absolutely.
All over the world.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's just thrilling to think of, especially for a kid who was never allowed to go to school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Short of going and learning the Quran through and through, you didn't have a classroom. You didn't get to learn.
Mm-hmm.
So it's double profound that somehow you have found your way to that kind of insight and education, and you're natural with language too, as you find out in the book, you know.
Yeah, there's a lot of us. You know, I'm not only Abdi. I think I have found the luck to really have access to publisher, you know, and advocate for my story, and that's what I did. But there are definitely thousands out there who have extremely amazing stories to tell. I have my own friends who have not only survived the war, but they have also survived a extremely dangerous journey by crossing the world's largest Sahara Desert between Sudan and Libya, and then got arrested and thrown in a prison in Tripoli for about 3 years, and we bailed them out, and they got into Italy, and the Italians put them in prison, you know. I mean, I did not do that. I didn't go through all this craziness after I left Somalia. Mine is just a piece of cake at some point when you look at, you know, how some other people are living their lives. Still, sitting in their own tiny rooms, you know, where someone is monitoring them 24/7, they have access to talk to me, you know, use WhatsApp, you know, send me pictures, and they're smiling. And, you know, that moment when they go out chopping some wood or doing something, you know, and I still see them. And then in my mind, I'm like, I grew with you guys. We were together. We went through everything. We survived the war. You went with me to the movie theater. You also speak English. But here I am. I got really lucky to get out. You did not. So I'm not going to take anything for granted, okay? I mean, you're a citizen. I should be happy. I should be grateful. But I should not forget about you. So basically what I'm trying to say is, I tell this story not just as a personal story. I really need to tell it as well, or weave it in a way to shed a light on the plight or the difficulties that come with leaving a place that you know well.
Yeah, after reading your book, to hear you describe your plight as a piece of cake is laughable at best, because it wasn't easy. There was nothing piece of cake about it, but it can be so much worse for other people too. It's important to keep it in perspective.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're telling this story for personal reasons and for political reasons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we don't know the story, we won't act differently in the future.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
So who's Max Alexander?
Max Alexander is an American writer and editor. He lives in Maine, and he and I met when I was shopping for an editor, you know, someone who really looks at my story and the way I put my English is not my first language. I'm not even thinking in English, right? So Max Alexander and I used to hang out here. He lives in a place called Camden, Maine, which I could also drive, you know, once every week when I was working on my story. So Max has really become more than an editor. He became a friend of mine who was enamored by my story, because he definitely had seen a few chapters that I already wrote in advance and that I sent to him. And then he was more than happy to work with me, you know, regardless of the contract, you know, and other things. But he became my co-writer, someone who helped me shape the story in a foreign language, meaning I wrote the book in Somali. And I'm also a well-trained professional translator, so I'm able to move the story, you know, from the subject language to the target language. So English was what I needed to write my story. And so what I would do with Max is write down a chapter without even seeing him. So I would take a whole week, hunker down, looking at my computer, drinking 10 cups of coffee a day, or sometimes 20 cups of tea a day, you know, and writing my story. And then I would go to him, and before I go, I just send a few stuff to him. So he would look through and take some notes. And so he would say, what is this? What is that? What is this? What is that? And he would act as an audience. an American reader, and he would look at the story and he would say, I love it. Or he would say, I don't get here. I don't really understand the message that you're trying to convey. And then we would discuss and we come up with the best way that I could really say it. You may have noticed it, or the readers of Call Me American may also notice that there's a lot of Somali words that are included in my book throughout the chapters. And Aurora is one of them. That this is a plant that my mom had used to soothe or use as a medication to really put on our wounded heels or foot. And we found the English version of it, but I decided not to use the English version of it because I think it takes the meaning away from what I'm trying to say. And Max was completely okay with that. I would talk to him about it, and my publishers were completely okay with that. I had to advocate for that as well. So basically, Max is really wonderful now-turned friend who is himself an author, lived in Congo. So he lived in Congo for a little while, and he has a sense of the African culture a little bit. I'm not saying Congo is the same as Somalia, but at least he lived on the land, as we say.
Yes, I think that's great. You know, anytime you're doing a creative project, to have somebody to bounce ideas off of, and mm-hmm. make sure it makes sense. And, you know, didn't you already say that once? You know, that kind of thing is invaluable. Right. And your book is so smooth that I think that all that upfront work pays off for the American reader. It is so easy to consume. I just loved it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for taking all the time to sort it out and put it down in a way that was so easy to take up. It gave me great insight. I've met a number of people who've been refugees, and I've met a number of people from Somalia, but I didn't have the whole story in my head that you painted for me. And it's humbling. And I think it will change the way I feel when I meet Somalis in the future, having just more understanding of what day-to-day life looked like. Mm-hmm. Even just getting water, being so perilous. It's truly amazing that you lived just to get water for your family. I don't know how you made it through all the years of doing that. You know, with snipers looking to pick you off for sport and needing to do that at night and huge heat and barefooted. And, you know, it's just unimaginable, that kind of stress day after day.
As we speak now, people are living through that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not done.
It's not done. Yep.
Good point. So what's it feel like to be an author at 35? Did you ever imagine that that was in your future when you were 15?
No. I mean, I knew that I was a storyteller. Let's say years back, I did not have an idea on how I would tell this story in a larger audience. So being an authorship is not a lifelong dream that I had growing up. But being out there and telling my story is something that I could do. I have put my life on the line, or technically risked my own life by telling my story when I was in Somalia. So when I came here, I realized that, you know, I have the space and the freedom that I need to tell my story. So at 35 today, and being an author, it actually feels, I think I am excited because I feel like I'm part of a change that's happening, not only to the Americans who need to understand more about us, but also starting some sort of a path for those who also want to tell their stories. I volunteered with the Telling Room for a little while after I authored my first book, you know, and then talking to other younger kids who were mostly predominantly immigrants, you know, to say, hey, you went to high school here. I did not. And I wrote a book that people are reading, right? And then they would just be like, so I can do it, huh? And I said, you can definitely do it. All you need is to just believe in yourself and you can do so. I see those people and I see their eyes and I see their communication. And I see what they write. And then I see how much I'm contributing to it. And the positive that carries, specifically in today's America, when politicians are just using us and our stories the way they want. We live in a Trump time, and he uses our stories the way that he wants by basically saying these people are dangerous. So if we don't have the other narrative, we don't have anything else to tell the people. So I'm enjoying definitely to have my story out there, people reading and people passing the book each other and like saying, oh, I should really send this to my daughter who's in college. And I want her to read. And the daughter is reading and she'll be like, I'm going to share this with my friends. And now I'm connected with a whole book club and Trump supporters as well who read my book. And I believe changed their minds in terms of, I mean, they have their other reasons to, you know, love this guy and vote for him. But I think at least it breaks down the barrier that, like, man, these people have been through a lot that I could not imagine I went through. But these people are here and surviving and they deserve it, you know? That's what they need to see and the human side of the story. And I humanized it. So, yeah.
And for people who might not pick up a book and spend the time to read the story, they may soon get a chance to know the story anyway, because you've signed a contract to make a film. And I wondered if you could tell us what's happening next with that.
Yeah, you know, people love visual stuff.
Including you.
Including myself. because, yeah, I think it, like sitting on the couch and watching is a lot easier than opening a book and reading it, right? So there's a lot of people like that. So I'm really happy to announce that a documentary of Call Me American, the story, my family's story, Somali's story, immigrants, refugee story, is going to be put into a lot of episodes. And then it will come to the theater for anybody to watch. And I signed that contract. And the way it works is we're working on the script right now. So it should be on Netflix or HBO or somewhere else, you know, one way or another. It's going to be right there in the theater or in your laptop. But to describe this, the story, the visual story is more, I think, like the image of the book. So there's going to be a lot of the scenes that you see, and we're not basically editing anything. Because I'm the author, I'm heavily involved in this, in the process of writing this story. So there is a combination of the beautiful Somalia, when Somalia was absolutely such a place that the world wanted to come in summertime, and then how a country quickly shifts from a civil society into a civil war, and what that shift really brings. I think for anybody in the world to really see and understand the meaning of like peace and government and, you know, trusting your community and things like that. We humans are just crazy when things really fall apart. So we'll be including that. And also basically, you know, at the end, we're going to be adding a lot based on being someone from Africa, but who's not African-American, and the identity crisis in this country and how you get tagged and labeled, you know, and I've never been called a black man anywhere before the US until I landed here. And I couldn't even just understand why I just was black. Why? Why is it about my skin color? Just why? I don't get it, right? Because I did not grow up in this country, and I just came here believing that it's okay to be black. It's normal. You're not looking dangerous, you know? And then I could, within the documentary, I could connect this with being in Somalia, where being a young man with no mustache or beard sounded more like a dangerous thing to this specific group that are armed and is running the whole town. Or if you had a long beard and you're a young man, you could have been an Islamist. So I also live that life where, damn, how am I supposed to look? What am I supposed to dress? Well, now that I lived that, I was very excited. Came to Kenya. Now in Kenya, right? Being a Somali and looking like a Somali was dangerous. So meaning, I wrote it in the book as well. I had to hide, I had to run, and this. Now I came to a place that I dreamed, the dead end. I'm not going anywhere from here. But the dead end is also confusing and crazy, and I don't want this. But I can't escape it. And so I live in this bubble of identity and being a black man and the era of George Floyd. And so I don't ever wake up these days feeling safe, honestly. You know, I run, go for a ride, I drive, I go hike, and what's going to happen to me? I have no idea, you know. Is someone going to shoot at me? Is someone going to call 911 on me? You know, is someone going to suspect me of someone that I look like someone who really brought some drugs into the state? So that's what goes in my mind, and I don't deserve that.
No.
It's a sad America.
Yes, it is. And I think it's a really important point that you make, that when you were from Somalia, everyone was black. So there's no stigma that goes with being black. Mm. But here, for a number of reasons, you don't feel safe.
Yeah, yeah.
In a pretty darn safe town.
I don't. Yeah.
That says a lot. Today's broadcast is the first half of an hour-long interview with Abdi Iftin. Please join us next week for the second half. As ever, the views shared in this program belong to the individual sharing them, and not necessarily the station or the University of Southern Maine. I'm Kate Manahan. Thanks for joining us today. for much of your childhood, you longed to be an American to the extent that people called you America. And this past January, you became a U.S. citizen. I wondered if you could tell us about that day. Was there part of the naturalization ceremony where it felt like your dream had come to life and everything was in extra sharp relief?
I think January 17, for those in Maine that day, it was a freezing day. It was really freezing. We had snow on the streets. It snowed overnight. But it was a sunny day, but it was really freezing. It was very cold. And each moment built up a very deeply emotional feeling in me. I mean, I woke up with a journalist sitting in my kitchen, right? Wanting to capture every moment. And here I am taking a shower and putting on my blue suit and my stars and stripes tie, the American flag. I was ready for it. I was really, really, really excited. And why was I excited? Well, first of all, even though I was 34 years old, I had never had a legal document that has my name, either a passport or an ID. Well, the green card, yes, of course, but it's not a nationality. So even though I grew up in Somalia, I didn't have a nationality document. Nothing. No birth certificate, no passport. So I think that day, I kind of felt a shift or a switch kind of happening in my own life. You know, I went up and friends of mine who had known that this was happening just came together, hundreds of them. I have a few friends who flew from Arizona just for the moment of that and stayed in a hotel, and then they walked up to the Portland Pier, which is a huge building that sits by the water, Gateway Ocean is what's called Pier. Oh my goodness, I think the moment that the switch turned on was when I raised my right arm with 46 other immigrants from 26 different nationalities, all raised the same hand, and we took the Oath of Allegiance. And that Oath of Allegiance and the words that followed from the people at USCIS, United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, saying, congratulations, now you are American citizens. So those were the words that actually brought tears in my eyes. You know, I couldn't believe it. It basically just happened, you know, and all the hags, you know, and people taking pictures and Americans. You know, I think what was so moving also was like, other than a few immigrants that came, it was a bunch of white people who just came to witness the Abdi who had the long American dream. His nickname was Abdi the American. The nickname becomes my nationality. I'm a truly Abdi the American.
Against all odds.
Against all odds, yes.
That was an amazing day.
Gosh, yeah. And I you know what was so exciting is, well, they said, congratulations, you're now a citizen. And then they said, you have to know that now you can vote. You can run for office. You can serve in a jury. You're an American. You can go anywhere. And each time the woman said those words, I think my heart has been beating faster. Just because it was so momentous. I believe no American ever feels this way. But things like that, people should bring their kids, because students who came over could not believe, you know, how emotional it was. And I walked up to the desk before we left and I registered my name as a Democrat. And I said, I'm going to vote, you know. And then I voted in the primaries this year. Let's see. And then we partied the same evening, January 17th. We invited friends to come together at the Yarmouth Library here in this town. And I stood there. And each, you know, I let everybody take the mic and say what they want. And then they were talking about the emotional moments, you know. And local television has captured my day story and it's been aired on the news that evening. And local newspapers also wrote about it. So what does this mean? First of all, I became a Mainer, a real Mainer, not the immigrant guy anymore, right? And I became an American. And I call here home. I know it's very sad. It's a bad time. But now I think you know what I mean by... I hope that America stands up to those expectations, to those tears that were on my eyes, to those emotional moments. And then when I think of today's America, racism, discrimination, xenophobia, I don't know. It just feels like a betrayal of what happened that day. It really does. The president doesn't understand, you know. People who hate us don't understand. But if you really think that I hate this country, if you think immigrants don't care about this country, you should have been there that day to just witness it. Even though the allegiance of oath that I took said, give up loyalty to your country of origin, I still had tears in my eyes. What does that tell you? I love this country. I don't hate my native country. But that moment is a moment that I have worked on for my entire life. And if you tell me that I don't deserve to be here, that I am not as equal as everybody else, that I am a threat to this country, it's a betrayal. And you're not a true American. The true Americans are the people who came up there that day and just had tears in their eyes and partied with us.
It's part of the dream.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And I think... the immigrants I've met certainly have a better understanding of what it is to be an American than an American with no cultural reference elsewhere. You know the difference, mm-hmm. and you've chosen it for yourself under great peril. And with just a fair amount of luck and hope and all kinds of, you know, little things wired together to make it happen, mm-hmm. I can't even imagine... I can't imagine what that day must have been like. Mm. We strive so much of the time, strive. But that's one day when you just were right where you wanted to be all along.
Yeah.
And I think we're awfully lucky to have you.
Thank you. It feels liberating. And that was a liberating day, I think. Liberating from what? From the stress and anxieties, because I could have been deported before I became a U.S. citizen. Just for no reason. You don't even have to commit a crime. But they just say, you're not American. You're not, you know, an American. So that's the fear that I lived since Trump was elected. But June 17th, taking the oath and becoming a U.S. citizen, now with a U.S. passport in my pocket, you know, I can't stand up to these bullies and flocks, you know, so I'm not gonna give up.
I like
fighting for the American dream.
Oh, yeah. Don't give up on it. I like that you invite everybody to go to a naturalization ceremony. And watch it. It really is something. I've been to a few, and I'm struck by them and moved by them every time. They move around to different schools, and children sing songs and perform things, and there's art, and the feeling at these events is powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, each person has a story.
Yeah. And I think it's a turning moment. I think every American, one way or another, should really go and experience what it means for people to become U.S. citizens. Okay, so 46 different nationalities that day. 26 different nationalities, right? Guess who included? A British man and a French man and a Portuguese man. I mean, like, Europeans are with us.
Oh,
alongside
sure.
A Somalian, Sudanese, and Burundian. What? You know, and then it just shows you what America is. That's America. That's the definition of America. America is a land of immigrants. And we all took allegiance to the flag and to this country. And I'm really not ashamed to say I'm more patriotic than many native-born Americans. And I think 46 of those of us there that day are more patriotic than people who were born in this country but don't understand what this country is all about. So if they really think that immigrants are not adding anything to this country, oh man, you're wrong. You know, we're not just popping up from the ground like a plant. We have been through a lot. There's talents we bring with ourselves. We're just taking all the courage and whatever we can to learn the English language by also speaking our own native language, in addition, that so many Americans don't have. And here we are, loving it and becoming nationals of Americans. And in the future, if I have a baby, my baby's going to be an American. Just the same way like your own great-great-grandfather, or maybe even your mom, your dad, came from somewhere else, came to this country by boat and had you, right? That's America. I'm not saying I want my kid to grow up not speaking Somali, but I think the beauty of this country really includes inclusion, the diversity.
Makes us strong.
The different food, yes. It makes us strong and it makes us very exceptional. That's why people don't go to Russia and China. That's why everyone in this planet dreams. That's why there's the American dream. I've never heard of the Russian dream. Or the European dream. Doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In reading your book, I was struck by the contrast of what you were seeing in the streets of Mogadishu and the ones you were imagining in the U.S. as you watched Rambo and other films. What did you think life would be like here as a Muslim man, as a black man? And how's that measuring up to your expectations?
I mean, I was hoping that, honestly, I was hoping when I learned America by way of movies, I was hoping that I wanted to live in an environment that's welcoming. If I wanted to practice my faith and walk up to the mosque, that I could do that. If I wanted to not do that, that I wanted to not do that, you know, but I was hoping to be accepted, not based on my similarity, not based on because I want to eat bacon or I want to eat pie, you know, things like that. But I was hoping that in America, it should be okay to be a Somali, completely okay to be a Muslim, and completely okay to speak Somali. You know, you don't even have to bother speaking English. But then I realized that as you come into this country, I have to explain a lot of things because not many people understand. You know, I mean, I have to find myself compromising a lot of things in my own culture to just fit into this society that, you know, that we live with today, by doing what they do, by fixing what kind of food we fix, by shopping at their, you know, stores. So I don't think there's a lot of energy put into, you know, by the society into understanding or accepting, you know, the way of life that we do in Somalia. So with that, it comes with the stress and sometimes the culture shock, you know, and things like that. So I have technically Americanized myself in so many ways, you know, to just realize, you know, you cannot really be straight Somali in this country. You can't just, you know, wake up, wear your Maui's, you know, and run around. That's not how it works, you know, because that may make you look like a weird person because that's not how they dress in here. So I put on my pants, and if I go hiking, I just put on whatever Americans put on, you know, and just go for a bike ride, drive, you know. There's no tea shop that they have outdoors. It's just Dunkin' Donuts. That's the only way that you can go, or Starbucks. So it's like really getting to know the American. I'm not from Europe. If some people migrate from Europe, they might understand the system here. But to me, it's just every little bit of, you know, thing out there is just educational. You have to learn.
Sure. Did not grow up with refrigerators.
No.
If you're just joining this conversation, welcome. You're listening to New Mainers Speak. I'm Kate Manahan, and my guest today is Abdi Iftin. Not only is he a student at Boston College studying political science, but he is also an advocate for refugee organizations such as Refugees International, Chicago Refugee Coalition, and Oxfam. Abdi is the author of a book called Call Me American. In your book, you take on some really big themes, things like female genital mutilation, tribal divisions, religion, and punishment. You're talking about things that are not always comfortable topics, and you've met with some pushback from people. I wondered if you'd want to explain what that's looked like for you. What's that been like?
Yeah. You know, these are the things that were bugging me a lot, you know, back in Somalia. I understand it's a culture, but I think if we don't talk about it, we're not going to resolve this. women in Somalia have certain limitations on what they need to do, but it's mostly men dictating things. You know, FGM is widespread in Somalia because men are happy, because men want women to go through that so that they can marry her, you know. And if I'm that man who is from Somalia and who can really speak up against this, it just is the start of a real conversation, which I already feel like it's happening. However, these are taboo, and you could risk your own life talking about these kind of things because you're really diving deep into the cultural elements that were never questioned. You can never question these kind of things, right? My own family don't agree with me taking a stand on this, you know, side. I'm rebellious, you know. I really like to think freely and think my own way and come to a conclusion. And I'm not technically saying America has changed me or turned me into a feminist, you know, depending on how you define feminism. But the only thing that I can tell you is if I was born a woman, I would not be here. My sister, who's younger than me, has been married 14, now has 5 kids. That would be me, okay? So I need to know that. I need to know that I took advantage of my male privilege. And I need to know that that puts me higher than, you know, certain women. And if I don't mention that, I'm sort of betraying my own story. And I really wanted to include that. Yes, I got a pushback and definitely angry voices and faces from members of the community, but that was not unusual. The thing is, it was a way to bully me into not really speaking public. There were certainly a group of men that organized a mob to attack places that, not attack, but like send emails to try to stop me from speaking those kind of stories. Social media smearing, you know, which basically happens when you become somebody. These have all failed, mostly because I think usually the truth wins. But the truth is painful. I don't know if you know, there's a Somali author, her name is Ayan Hirsi. I don't agree with everything that she says, but I totally disagree that she's been disowned entirely by the Somali community by speaking up and writing memoirs of her own story. And so somehow it's really not easy to publish a memoir like this, talking about your own stories within your own community. So you definitely have to get a backlash because you can't make everybody happy. The only way that you can make everybody happy is to cover up. And I did not want to do that. But I also, as my male privilege has really somehow worked because I haven't received as intense heat as if I was a woman, right? Because being a woman, man will just not like when you start speaking up. And I'm not giving up. So by now, I work with a group of young Somali women as well who are desperate to tell their stories. And I'm one of a rare man who just says, yep, I like it. I really like that you're talking about your story. You should not have been through this FGM. Just talk about it. Your mom was okay with it. Let's talk about it. It's okay. We live in a different world. Your story matters. But how about backlash? How about if they kick me out of the house? Just put up with it, okay? Just leave. You live in a free world, find an apartment, and your family will come to realize the truth, and then they'll get back to you.
Wow, it's a powerful stand.
Yeah.
I think the key word here is taboo.
Yes.
You know, it's the shoot the messenger kind of thing. Mm-hmm. When the person comes in and says what you don't want to hear, it's just easier to knock them off than to realize what they're saying needs to be heard.
Yeah.
It's courageous.
Yes, it is. Yes. Yeah. And I should say, as a writer, don't ever get anybody bully you. Don't ever get anybody edit or censor what you want to say. As long as you are truthful and are really speaking from, you know, an honest heart, just go ahead and write it. How many Somali women are raped and are sexually assaulted in our community by members of our community? They don't talk about it. I'm not making this up. It is within the community, and I would love them to have taken advantage of the Me Too movement and, you know, get this man who's actually doing this kind of a thing up there and let's talk about those issues, because if you do, we're going to have thousands just merge the same way that you did. You know, so it's not happening. How about that young girl who was deceived into going to Somalia and she had been through the FGM and she came back here and the teachers at the high school figured it out and they went to the doctor and the parents now are at court, you know. How about those things? Do we need to talk about those things? Yes, we need to talk about those things. We need to put the parents up there to just tell them that they're wrong. Because these young girls are suffering. You know, how many times did I try to hang out and date a Somali woman and the parents said, no dating, you guys need to get married? How many times did I get frustrated? And because of that frustration, in chapter 16, I put part of that story to really sort of like put it out there as a reminder that we need change, right? That there was someone I loved so much, dearly in my heart, and it was the same. She loved me back. But the parents are just so ridiculously attached to
tradition.
To tradition. And even though we respect the tradition, we also want, to be our own people, to figure things out our own way. And when we decide, you know what, I just want to settle down and have a baby. If we agree, let's do it. Mm-hmm. We were not even there. It was just 2 weeks into this thing. And now here we go, you know. So I didn't like those kind of things. And so I had the courage to definitely write that down as well.
Where does this courage come from?
I think it comes from being who I am. I'm not saying I'm the only one who has the courage. Every member within our community has the courage, but some people don't want to say it because they find it shameful, taboo, or things like that. To me, there's nothing taboo. If you're gay in the community, come out. I don't find it taboo. You're totally fine. I want to accept you as who you are. Don't be afraid of what your parents are going to feel, okay? So I think we need some strength, and that's what I carry myself. I'm not really... I mean, particularly speaking right now, there are certain parties of the Somali community that I'm not invited to come. You know why? Because I said things that are taboo, that are unacceptable.
You broke ranks. Like nobody would know people were being sent home to Somalia for female genital mutilation unless you were talking about it. Now people know, and now they assume things, and we don't want them to assume things about us.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but also I find it cheap when someone says, you're just really giving the Trump people some credit. Not credit, but like you're just giving them a
fueling
win.
Fueling the fire.
Right, by really telling them the shame things are like that. And then, you know, the only thing I would say is this true or no? Are we really talking about something true or am I just making this up? As long as this is true, I don't give a crap who feels what. So I'm going to go ahead and say that, because I think it's not Trump people are not my audience, but I'm also talking to the progressive liberal Americans who have no idea who we are. It's important that they get to know us, that we're humans, we're nice people, but we also have taboos and things like that. Okay, if we don't talk about that, I don't want to just sit here and keep saying, we're a community, just leave us.
I don't think there are any communities that don't have their taboos. They're just different things sometimes.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. There are a lot of people that live with a lot of secrets.
Right.
So your book was just re-released last week with edits around some of the more graphic grief scenes and then with additions. This time your book's aimed at young readers. What do you want young people to get from your story?
Okay, first of all, we are in a time in America where we need to empower our young people. Once, speaking from racism to discrimination to the way you see immigrants and refugees, my first edition, Call Me American, was inappropriate for young teens and anybody under 16. They couldn't absorb the painful memories that I talked about, including a loss of a family member and burying my own sister when I was 7 years old. This is something that most American kids don't understand. And I toured around schools talking to kids, and I memorized all their questions. They have lots of questions. They motivated me into thinking of answering those questions. And I, you know, the questions that they ask is just basically, you know, something like, what was a childhood like in Somalia? What games did you play? What was going on through in your mind? Without school, did you feel free and happy? You smiled. Why did you smile? you played, how did you play? With an empty belly, you know? You loved your mom when you lived on the streets with no home. How did that even happen? When some of us just get angry and maybe want to move out our houses because mom texts the video games, you know? And I loved it. I loved it so much. And I listened to these kids. And every time I came back from speaking to them, I would just not wait to sit and put together those thoughts. And those thoughts are put in this new book to really answer to them how I did it. So what does this mean? This means if they read The Young Adults Who Called Me American, they get motivated into becoming better humans, into not only loving this country, but also loving the world and those of us who, you know, basically come here. And I think I see it as a cross-border thing, you know, where many Americans aren't exposed to those kind of stories. You know, you don't understand. You see Somalia as one place in Africa, but you don't really, you know, understand what people go through and how a child living there through the famine and the civil war could just even survive to become this grown-up man who stands in front of you in the class, dressed up nice and talking to you, you know, and remembers all your names without me acting like I'm really mentally not fit because I went through that. You know, I'm not saying that. So it sort of encouraged them to go through the difficult days ahead, if there is any, and maybe to also appreciate what they have, roof over their head, clothes in their bags, food on the table, possibility of going to college, you know, after graduation, possibility of finding a job, and maybe become better Americans that way, you know. And maybe that will help break down the sense of racism, discrimination, because I think to those little kids I spoke to at high schools across the nation, if they grow up, finish college, I'll probably be, I don't know, 45, 50 years old. I think what I told them helps them to carry through their years to come. But they also need to continue this. It's not only Call Me American. I am also taking advantage of this podcast now by saying, if you're an immigrant, please write your story. It helps. It changes. It adds. It contributes to the progress of not only this country, but to the whole world. Do it, man, do it.
I think your mom would be so proud of you because she cared so much for her stories that she had memorized and shared the things that she'd done in the bush and the things her relatives had done in the bush. And now you write your story down, which is part of her story. And you encourage everyone else to write their stories down. And then those stories can get into so many more brains, so many more ears and eyes. Mm-hmm. And it changes what we think about the world. We certainly don't learn about most of the world in school.
Yeah.
So this is a way to educate ourselves through your stories, through your eyes. I think it would be very hard to read your book and then have a thought where you want to say to somebody, go back to Somalia. I don't think you could do that.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
So what's next for you? The big dream. What are you hoping you'll be doing in 5 years? And, you know, what's the big picture look like for you?
It's really hard to tell, but I think I'm ambitious that I would pursue the storytelling narrative to change the world. And I will go on any platform or form that I can to do that, if it includes empowering young immigrant writers, or even if it is young, native-born American writers, you know, anything that I can do to get storytelling out there, from taking off from my own story and taking off from my own experience. So I kind of want to build that platform where we can interact, we can tell stories to each other, we can bring music into, you know, there. That's what I envision for the next 5, 10, 15 years, I guess. I'm not looking forward to moving to an expensive city and disappear. That's not me. I'll always be there available for anybody.
Do you have any places that you'd like to travel to now that you have an American passport?
Gosh, yes, there's a long list of things. Actually, I haven't even discovered the whole country yet. There are a lot of places that I've not been to, and those some places that I have been to that I didn't have enough time to see. But I also love the world. I just want to see, I want to go back to where I came from, not this time as a refugee, but as a U.S. citizen, and see that, see the power that that really has, something that I need to put in my next book as an experience. But I don't, I respect and love the beauty of this planet that we have. I would love to go and long trip, road trips, you know, if possible, or sometimes even just go, you know, see other people, other differences, other cultures. Like, I've never been to Asia. I have no idea, you know, unless I generalize, but, you know, I would love to just see the beauty of life there and, you know, how people do things. And so I'm adventurous, and I think I'll be using that a lot.
Yeah. As a child, you had very few options open to you. You could become a soldier or an imam. And now you are an author, a student, an advocate, and you're making your own American dreams come true. I wish you all the best as you continue to navigate life's challenges and travel around the world and encourage other people to become their best selves.
Thank you, Kate. I appreciate that. And thank you so very much. It was wonderful talking to you.
And thank you for being my guest today. If you would like to hear this complete interview or interviews from previous weeks, please visit newmainersspeak.com. I'm Kate Manahan, closing today's program with a song that Abdi has selected for us. I wondered if you could tell us about why you chose this song.
You know, I really wanted to keep an eye on the immigrants who are becoming musicians in this country. And I wanted to select something that's pretty close home. And I found these young Somali immigrants in Vermont who have the name A2VT. VT standing for Vermont. And A standing for Africa, Africa to Vermont. So the song that I have is Fas Wa. And it is kind of a like rap music, and it includes English and Somali together, and I think it just speaks, you know, about the moment, the joy, the diversity, you know, and the struggles of everyday life as a kid.
What does Fas Wa mean?
Fas Wa means just it is.
Okay, yeah. It is.
Yeah.
By mm-hmm. A to VT.
Yep, A to VT.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
As ever, the views shared in this program belong to the individual sharing them, and not necessarily the station or the University of Southern Maine. I'm Kate Manahan. Thanks for joining us today. As ever, the views shared in this program belong to the individual sharing them, and not necessarily the station or the University of Southern Maine. I'm Kate Manahan. Thanks for joining us today.